You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Jonathan Payne and Martin Borosz, welcome to Token Theater Friends. Thank you for joining me. So we can get started. Can you describe what Address List is for our viewers and our listeners?
Yes.
Do you want to go first, Jonathan?
I guess I can. The idea started with Martin and I picked up the mantle. But basically what Dressless is at its heart is an experience that helps audiences understand what homelessness is in New York. And that is portrayed through three characters who all experience housing insecurity in some way. And the audience is in charge or working with them towards making decisions in their daily lives. The hope is that they can earn enough money for housing. So a lot of these decisions are around whether they'll earn money or maintain their health. And hopefully they earn housing by the end of the experience.
And as a genre, maybe we can refer to it as an interactive online play. Mm-hmm. Because it's an immersive experience that people can take part via Zoom, and it features a lot of pre-recorded scenes and interactive parts as well. And it's a contemporary computer theatrical game that I sometimes call a strategy or survival game also because of the above mentioned reasons. But it's also some kind of a democracy game because as Jonathan described, the audience is divided to teams and they represent their fictional characters. And in certain dilemmas, they need to get to a consensus. So they often vote and there's a collective will that will decide upon besides fortune about the fate of the characters.
I'm really fascinated by the structure of the game because when I experienced Addressless, I kind of felt like it was the anti-Monopoly and it made me feel really guilty about playing Monopoly and like fighting with my brothers when I was little over fake dollars. While here what we have is, you know, the stakes, the lives of actual people are up to us and what decisions we help them take. Can you talk a little bit about how you were able to cope with that, with creating this game structure and letting go of the fact that once the audience comes into participation, the stakes of your characters are no longer up to you, but to what the audience decides to do? Mm.
Maybe I should give a little context about the history of the performance because that can give a key. So generally some of the game structures were inherited from an actual board game that was developed back in Hungary by a group of social workers, sociologists, and people with lived experience with housing insecurity or homelessness. And this structure that Jonathan described, whether you risk health or risk your financial stability, at certain points was part of that game already, but not the scenes. So that was some sort of an anti-monopoly game, but with a lot of research behind of it and a lot of expertise. And this is the structure we borrowed for the sake of the theatrical event. And for me personally, it was helpful in terms of not finding it a bizarre idea that we are transposing people's life into points and refer to life expectancy or energy as points and monetary consequences as it was just a gamey point, and also a great excuse for people to take part in something that's not dictated by pity or sorrow, but it's actually they are part of an entertaining, joyful, collective experience that's also very meaningful, but they at the same time can be confronted with what reality is and what can only happen within the framework of the game.
Mm-hmm. It's been fascinating to see it functioning. Martin had the pleasure of seeing it live in front of an audience, and this is my first time seeing it in front of an audience, and I think the magic of that structure is when I see people respond to the outcomes, there's a lot of like, oh no, or, you know, there's a lot of like, yes, I'm happy that happened, or there's a lot of rooting for the characters, and that's what's really exciting and almost moving to see, is that there are people who are thinking about these characters and their situations and trying to support them to the best of their abilities in a structure that is unknown to them and is harsh and unforgiving. And I think watching people respond the way they do to outcomes is really at the heart of the experience, because they are looking through that person's eyes. They are responding to those moments in real time. I think that's the magic of the structure. I think as the playwright, I was very focused on thinking about the characters and the situations that they were coming across, and using my experience as a social worker during the day. Yeah, adapting those stories into the play. And so that was a lot of excitement, is building those moments and guiding people towards making those decisions and the surprise of those decisions.
Yeah, I was very stressed when there's a point when one of the characters is being urged to jump the turnstile in the subway. And I cannot think of anything more stressful in New York City than figuring out if you want to do that, if you're, that's something that you even want to try, because as the show points out, there is a discrepancy in the number of times, for instance, that a person of color, a Black man, for instance, would be stopped by the cops if he does that, than if a drunk white teenager does it. So that I was biting my nails when that was happening. And I wanted for you to talk a little bit about when you started the show, Martin, in 2016 in Hungary, were there parallels with the ways in which people in Hungary and in Europe see homelessness and homeless people compared to the way in which Americans see it?
Yeah, this is a very crucial question, I think. So I think there is a misleading image that we often think of when we hear the word homelessness, and I think it's no difference between how European or an American person would think about this. So this image that implies mostly those people who live on the streets, people who struggle with mental health issues, people who struggle with addictions. And no matter how liberal or well-informed the society is, if you don't have the overview on this structural question, that it's really connected to housing politics and social politics. And it's essentially, if I want to oversimplify it, it's about low wages and unaffordable or lack of affordable houses. It's really a very complex question, way more complex than that most visible segment of the homeless society, because we often forget about families who are homeless or people who couch surf. So they actually have a roof sometimes above their heads, but it's not a predictable way of living. Or all those people who go to work every day, but they have to go to work from a shelter or from a transitional housing. So I think there are these stereotypes in Hungary that was one of the reasons why we thought that we need to fight against prejudice. And also sometimes people don't see their responsibility in this whole structural complex problem. And in terms of the reception of the piece, I see some similarities, because it often happens that some of the teams cannot win the game. It's not impossible to win it, but it's hard because you need a good strategy, a lot of luck, and good partners and people who listen to you. So it's a little bit, in these terms, it's similar to homelessness. When people don't get to win the game, they feel it very unfair. How come that I'm a frequent reflected theater goer, I have 3 diplomas, and I wasn't able to win this game? Well, it's sometimes the system that has the problem within it, and it's not your fault as much as it. And that's the reason why victim blaming is not a way to approach this question. And some of these elements or motives I recognize when I talk to people in the States too.
Yeah, I think the interesting part of it was I was approached by Daniela at Rattlestick to take over the adapting of this play. And so I was handed this tome and I looked through it and I was like, oh, we are speaking the same language. There is very little difference here. This is all familiar, and this came all the way from Hungary. And so that's what was striking to me, is that Martin and I, we can meet in New York City and we can have the same language around homelessness, which, you know, that translates to, you know, a macro view of how we handle homelessness in society. And that was the most fascinating thing to me.
But also we needed to change the characters entirely, because that was not the most relevant, the original setup to a New York context. And there were some motives that were important in the original script, such as a street paper that's written, edited, and distributed by homeless people. And I think at least 3 of our scenes in the Hungarian version were inspired by the content of this paper and the whole phenomena. So that was something we very early on decided to cut and replace with other more pressing motives.
The evening that I attended, the performance that I attended, I was really fascinated by the fact that several concepts came up. And some audience members, some of my fellow audience members, had no idea what things like couch surfing meant, for instance. So I wonder, for the two of you, when you were working on the piece, were there any concepts that surprised you? Things that just like, you know, like threw you out of, you know, the oh, wow, I had no idea that this was a thing.
It's fascinating to me because my background wasn't in social work. I went to NYU and I was on this theater trend for a bit, and a friend, I was having trouble finding work, and a friend was like, why don't you try social work? And I was like, that doesn't make any sense, and why would I do that? And so it took me 3 years to find a job, and when I shifted into social work, that's when I found a job quite quickly, which was interesting. And so I think what is fascinating about the play is that the audience's experience is very much my experience of sitting with people who were formerly homeless and have their first apartment after a long, long time or never, and helping them make decisions towards independence. And so that is what, so a lot of the play is a lot of the stuff that surprised me back in, you know, back in the time in terms of, how homelessness can come about, how homelessness has a wide sort of definition. It's not just, you know, the typical wino in the corner. You know, I could be homeless. You know, there was probably a period where I was close to being homeless. I remember having to move because of bed bugs and trying to find an apartment in a few seconds and landing on a place, but wasn't sure how I was gonna pay for it. And I remember the apartment wasn't even finished, and I was like sleeping in this bathroom, sleeping in the only space that was available to me in the apartment because they were still working on it. And I was like, what is, you know, how did I get to this place? How did I get here with all of my degrees and all of my experience and all of my background? How can I end up in this place? And I think that is what is surprising, is how close homelessness can be to people. Yes, the diversity of housing insecurity.
I was hoping you could talk a little bit about what was it like to work together remotely? You know, what were some of the pros and cons of putting a play together and experience together from different continents?
So in a sense, like we all experience working in front of a screen and scheduling Zoom meetings, and or I think back then we started on Skype before the pandemic. So scheduling meetings and be spending so much time in front of a screen and not having that natural energy that comes through from an in-person meeting and all that, it's very exhausting. At the same time, it was possible because I didn't actually write a word in this script. We were brainstorming on what the dilemmas, the conflicts, the arcs of the scenes, the characters, and so on can be. But then Jonathan was the one who put it on the paper and came up with an actual scene that we were able to reflect on. And then, just like any other feedback session, we were talking about, we read it, we analyzed it, and continued brainstorming. So it was somehow natural or organic to this working style to only meet up from time to time. And we didn't need to sit in the same room for 8 hours every day. So that's why it was even possible to find our way in this remote method of working.
Yeah, and since it started years ago, we were able to, we had a little gathering together where we workshopped for a week or so. And I think that was a good space to build a rubric of how things would function and work. And so, and that was before the pandemic. So when the pandemic hit, we had already had a way of working through by screen. And distance. And it was great in a sense because I already had someone who knew how things worked. And so I could write stuff and, you know, I would go to the guru and Martin would say, well, I don't know about this, or maybe this wouldn't work and maybe we need to think about that. And so it was a great process in a sense that, A, usually as a playwright, you're sort of alone in a room and creating something, but this was great in the sense that I could go write and then come back and say, you know, what about this, you know? So that was a great and a cool process that I will most likely miss as a playwright in terms of, yeah, creating a piece of theater.
And also we had a series of consultations with experts, such as social workers, plenty of times. And it was also great to be able to digest and process it together and have someone to reflect on and to get inspired by these meetings. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about the audience for a little bit. It's like I was reading in the mission of Stereo Act, your theater company, Martin, you point out how important it is to have an audience and how the play is not necessarily a play until the audience shows up and there's an exchange of energy. So I wonder, what's it like to be a working theater artist during the pandemic when so many performances have had to become digital works? Has that changed the way in which you deal and the way in which you approach and what you expect from the audience? And the same for you, Jonathan, because you've seen your plays with people in the theater. And now you know, when you're with people, you're at home and they're in their own homes as well.
I think a reason why people go to theater or take part on performances in any genre is to allow themselves to get engaged and allow the piece to affect them. So no matter we are talking about a film or a theater or an online piece that's somewhat live, but still we watch it through a screen, the goal is to find forms that are able to engage people. And I think when it comes to screen, we obviously can't just make a performance that we are recording with two or three cameras and show the stage, because it turned out, I guess, for those who hasn't had that experience, last year, when most theater tried to find ways to engage their audiences. So I think in terms of addressless, the interaction is what really keeps the performance alive. And we found this dual format that we have the pre-recorded videos that allows more dense rhythm, better processed material. We were able to place sound design, animations, graphics, to film the scenes in a studio space, edit it adequately, and so on. But at the same time, we needed the live element of it too, so the audience really feels not just as spectators, but also as the creators of the event and their own experience, which is really important to me and for this project. In terms of other Stereo Act pieces, we normally, in the last 2 years, we worked on concepts with two simultaneous tracks, and we were thinking about also the live version and also an online version. And sometimes it's every single time an adaptation. So you can never do the same thing in both ways. But I must say that there are some positive outcomes of learning the ways and experimenting with the ways of making work for online, because although maybe tickets don't get cheaper magically, just because it's online, but people who live in other cities can also see the works, which is a great benefit, for example. So accessibility also comes to image, and maybe people start consuming other from other sources where they normally would. Just to give a very broad answer.
Yeah, it was very hard for me when the, well, a lot of people when the pandemic hit, but I because I came into the theater, I went to see a play and I was sitting amongst these people and we were, you know, we were breathing it in and listening and reacting in real time. And as someone who grew up quite shy and on his own and, you know, didn't socialize too much, I think that space became very magical and important to me. And, you know, it was the theater that opened me up, that helped me speak to people and make friends and all of that stuff. So that space is very sacred to me. And the pandemic landed and I was sort of like, well, you know, what does that mean for this sacred space? And you know, theater found a way. My wife is a scientist and she's like, theater is dead, you know? And I'm like, well, no, it always finds a way. You know, I think of those troops, I don't know, wandering through England in those carts and, you know, presenting pieces to, you know, the tiny folk. It always finds a way. And it's been really moving to see how people react to this play. And to still see a sense of community, even though it's in the digital sphere, that people can interact and react in real time and, you know, even have the power to stop the play sometimes and be like, you know, wait a minute, I think that person has more money than you say that person has, you know, you know, I see Shakespeare and I see those people, you know, in the front shouting at the actors on the stage. So it's been hard on the theater community, I can imagine. But that belief that theater cannot die and it always finds a way.
I wonder if the two of you are comfortable sharing about some, you know, new practices that you've discovered yourself engaging in. Because during the pandemic, have you taken up any, I don't know, new instruments? Have you learned how to do some sort of craft? Have you taken up any skills at home?
For me, when people were sheltered in place, that was when my son was born. So, I spent the pandemic in a one-bedroom apartment with a newborn and visiting in-laws. And we were all trapped together in a space and creating our own theater. But I think a lot of that focus has been trying to figure out where writing lives as a parent and how to also be there for my family, as well as my day job, which is social work. So a lot of telephone calling people and all that stuff. So I think a lot of the time was spent trying to figure out how do I remain a playwright? And this play has been very helpful in terms of, revisiting writing and actually having something. I'm very lucky in that sense that I had something to work on and focus on and push towards production. So I think the hobby has been my son and tried to figure out writing at the same time, as well as being pushed into more screen TV writing and stuff like that. I think that's been my life during the pandemic so far.
Congratulations on your baby.
Yeah, thank you so much. We can track how long the pandemic is by my son's birthday, who will be 2 years old in March. So it's pretty crazy.
What about you, Marvin?
So I think the life of the pandemic was very different, or the tendencies of the waves was very different in Hungary. And the first wave didn't hit that hard Hungary. And there was always this small little silences before the storm, over and over again, before a second, third, fourth, fifth wave hit. And somehow I was very lucky to be able to keep working. And one of the very significant plays I worked on was about care workers and about the crisis of care work. And I think this probably our focus would have been different if there wasn't for the pandemic. So it served as a very obvious theme. It's another piece where there were non-professionals with lived experience incorporated. And in other ways, in the formal, in the sense of, in terms of forms, we also produced a site-specific piece, which was way more flexible for a smaller audience, outdoors. So something that's a little more COVID-proof, but also something that's been interesting for me throughout my career. And also we filmed two short films that, and those, that kind of attitude, that kind of methodology, that kind of view, that skill was also helpful in terms of sharing our works and creating streamable versions for given productions.
And I think one of the great things about Addressless is that it's really a show that you can, you know, attend repeatedly on different occasions, because every time you're going to end up with something different, right? So with that in mind, would you like to invite our viewers, our listeners, to go to Addressless at Rattlestick?
Well, yes, you know, please come and support. We've worked hard on Addressless, and specifically in the pandemic, when the show was created to be presented in front of a live audience, the staff and people really came together to make this digital piece. We have a great cast, and we have a social worker named Hope Beaver, and a person with lived experience named Shams DeBaron, otherwise known as the homeless hero. And these are great sort of sources and great people to have in the piece. And so we run till February 13th, and we'd love to see you there.
Thank you, Jonathan Payne and Martin Borosh. Thank you so much for joining me. I hope to talk to you again in the future, and best of luck.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Jose.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.